ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Solari Report. This is Money and Markets with John Titus, and we're going to be dealing with some gaslighting. Tell us what our theme is, John.
Do you take your gaslighting turbocharged?
It's so bad this week that you can, no matter how bad it is, you can always come back to a state of amusement.
It's now ludicrous.
Yeah.
These stories. You're going to see that.
The problem is, though, it's not ludicrous in the sense that these stories are going to do tremendous harm.
That is a fact.
Right.
The gaslighting, they're taking it, you know, it's very serious, and they're taking it to dangerous levels.
Right.
As we'll see. The more I think about the success of this whole virus and pandemic narrative and the pseudoscience that gets passed as news and as reality, sets a very dangerous precedent. And we're beginning to see that this week.
Right.
I think that's my opinion.
So let's dive into Farmageddon.
Okay. Let's do that. And the first story this week is, this is from the CDC. Apparently somebody submitted a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, to the CDC saying, hey, you know, let me zoom in here and see this a little bit better. We want documents. Let's see if I can get highlight. We're looking for documents, CDC, that, here's the request that was submitted. Documents reflecting any documented case of an individual who never received a COVID-19 vaccine, who was infected with COVID-19 once, recovered, and then later became infected again, and three, then transmitted COVID to another person when reinfected. And that was the request. And CDC comes back and says, you could see up here, they quote it. CDC admits it has no record of an unvaccinated person spreading COVID after recovering from COVID. And so, and you could see that here in the next sentence. A search of our records has failed to reveal any documents pertaining to your request, which is quite astonishing that the CDC would have no records of that, because that's what they're telling you you need the vaccine for. That there's a failing with natural immunity, and that's why you need the vaccine.
Right.
Now they're saying, we don't have any there's no studies on that. There's no emails on that. That's unbelievable.
Right.
Actually, it's all too believable.
Well, if you look at the things that have come out about the U.S. health regulators in the last week, and we're going to get into some more of them, it's really shocking. They're not even trying to look credible.
Right. That's the key. It's almost like they want you to know this is fantasy. We're calling the shots.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they think they have a control structure in place that they can force the mandates, and they don't have to justify themselves. I mean, we saw circulating, we're not going to talk about it today, but a story of the head of the WHO in assuring someone of, you know, there's no reason for a child to have a vaccination, which of course we know, but it's interesting they should circulate the story of him repeating that.
Right. We're not going to get into that, but that's exactly right. In other words, and the CDC thing along the same lines, this document request, the FOIA request, and the fact that they don't have anything, really, to me, paints the CDC as a marketing organization. It's just a arm, the marketing arm of Big Pharma,
and a profit taking. Because remember, they make a lot of money on the vaccinations.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, but anyway, that's bat and lead off on Farmageddon. Let's move on. Next story in Farmageddon. This is really, it's in Farmageddon, but this really gets into the gaslighting. This is incredible. Okay. Doctor clinically diagnoses patient with climate change. So basically the story here, patient comes into the emergency room in British Columbia, struggling to breathe. Dr. Kyle Merritt, and I'm highlighting that name there, assessed the worsening wildfire smoke in the region exacerbated the patient's asthma. The doctor clinically diagnosed the patient with, quote, climate change, end quote. The entire story goes on, just quoting this single doctor, Dr. Kyle Merritt. There's no other source quoted in the entire article. Merritt's quoted 8 or 9 times.
So I'm assuming if this doctor really did do this, then the hospital has a code in its information system, and the insurance company has a code in its information system for climate change. In other words,
very interesting point.
Right. The infrastructure has been set up because they don't give a diagnosis that there's no code for.
Right.
Right. So you got to fill in the box. So if they filled in the box with climate change, it means there's a code.
Very interesting point. Right. The story does not mention that. But to me, the fact that there's one doctor, this looks like maybe a trial balloon.
It's a trial balloon.
You can't call a single other doctor. You can't even call them. There's nobody at the hospital to talk about this. You're going to take one guy's word for it, make a whole story out of it. Curious.
Right.
You know, a bit of journalism there.
Right. It's a trial balloon.
Anyway, it's a trial balloon, but I suspect that it's the first of many we're going to see. That climate change is just going to get out of control because of the success of this pandemic and the virus. They've succeeded. Now they can just stretch the nose of wax to whatever they want.
Right. So the problem with the magic virus is it can only last so long. But climate change is the gift that keeps on giving. It can go on forever.
That's a great point.
Right.
Yeah. You're right. Climate change. We've been evil for centuries, and we're going to pay for it. Okay. moving on in Farmageddon. Ongoing failure. Berkeley Department of Public Health pans Cal football program's major COVID outbreak. So 44 players on the team tested positive for COVID over the past week. There was evidently a prior week, some of the players had tested positive, and then they basically flouted all the health and masking protocols, and now they got 44 players. Interestingly enough, though, way down in this story, the key paragraph, you know, 8-9 paragraphs down, Cal football players are 99% vaccinated, the school has said, and that staffers also have a similarly high vaccination rate. And yet, despite that fact, you know, nobody ever questions, well, maybe the problem is the vaccines don't work. Do you think maybe we should go back to square one? No, they never even raise that as a possibility. Just like, well, everybody's been vaccinated. But 44 players, and the team rosters aren't that big. I think college football, the roster is 54.
Right.
So 44 is the vast majority of your players.
Right.
So query what this vaccine's about.
You know what I think. I think a huge amount of the stories we cover are really designed to cover over vaccine injury.
Right. That's an excellent point, and that's gonna fold back into eventually climate change, where
right.
climate change is going to be, you know, adduced as the bogeyman for what is really harm caused by vaccines and injections.
Well, it was really funny. I had a subscriber write in the other day, and he said, "You know, you focused me in April 2020 on the fact that I didn't need to worry about the virus. I needed to worry about the injection," and that's exactly how it's turning out.
Yeah,
not to say that you can't get a bad flu and you don't need to do something about it, but the injection is the danger here.
Right. Right. And it's clear that story of the football players, that there's really no upside to the injection. There's a lot of downside, but there's no upside to it at all. You know, everybody's getting infected. So
right.
Why'd you take it?
Right.
Anyway, moving on. This is a bad story. FDA buries data on seriously injured child in Pfizer's COVID-19 clinical trial. There's a lot to digest here.
Uh-huh.
Basically, a couple enrolls their 12-year-old girl, Maddie, and her two brothers in a clinical trial. Maddie is the one who takes the brunt of this story. Let me zoom in, maybe see a little bit better. She's previously healthy, energetic, full-of-life child. Within 24 hours of second dose, reduced to crippling, screaming-inducing pain that landed her in the ER. She said she felt like someone ripping her lungs out through her neck. It reported the injury to the principal investigator of the Pfizer trial at Cincinnati's hospital, where the vaccine clinical trial was occurring, and she was treated and admitted. They first tried to treat Maddie as a, quote, mental patient. So they're right away, they're just deny. It's her problem. Even after the mom did a press event on June 28th with Senator Ron Johnson, incredibly, neither Pfizer nor any health agency reached out in any manner to address Maddie's injury or to even obtain any additional information. That's unbelievable.
Right. I think they reported her condition finally as a stomach ache.
They kept, yeah, well, it's bounced around like a beach ball. This is an interesting number here. There's only 1,131 kids in this trial. And one of them has got serious injuries, and Pfizer doesn't say anything about it. The whole story is just amazing. Pfizer's denial, and also its indifference to the fact that a U.S. senator is involved. That tells you what Pfizer thinks of itself.
Right. Right. They think they have complete carte blanche to do what they're doing. Right. And yeah. It's interesting. Their job is not to make a vaccine that's safe. Their job is to simply engineer it so it looks safe. You know, right. So pretending it's safe is enough. As long as they get the pretense, that's enough.
That's right. Exactly right. And your child is not supporting what the purpose of the clinical trial is. It's science. It's marketing.
Right.
And so your child's screaming in pain. That's not helping our marketing. So we're not interested. We're not interested in your senator. So go away. Right. Leave us alone.
Well, we have another one like that from AstraZeneca, right?
I don't know if we do. It seems like we did, but I can't remember. Anyway, let's keep it going, and we shall see. I just don't remember off the top of my head. It seemed like we did, but anyway, first ever nationwide lockdown for the – oh, you know what? We do have one from AstraZeneca, and I know why we're not getting it to it. It's because it's a video.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's the video. I knew you were right. I was like, I didn't see any story on it. Anyway,
was just interesting because when we went through them, I realized, you know, if you look at the patterns of what they're trying to do, to take any information that's relevant to safety issues and delete it or make it secret, it's just one after another after another after another. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah, and we'll get to a reel of that, one after the other after the other after other in a bit.
Okay.
This story is interesting, though, from its source. This is the Megyn Kelly Show. So let's just roll this clip. Let me set this up by saying, again, it's parents enroll the child in the trial, and things go bad. They go sideways.
Now, this is AstraZeneca, right?
I think so. Yeah. But let's play the clip, and we'll see here.
And what happened?
So right after she got the shot, we were driving home and she said, something doesn't feel right. She had tingling down her arm where she got the shot. Mm-hmm. She started to notice that her vision was changing. Her ears became very, very sensitive to sound. Her eyes were so sensitive to light, she had to put on the darkest sunglasses. Later that night, she had the typical vaccine response that they tell you to expect, you know, the fever and all of those things. But that had resolved by morning. However, she experienced new symptoms that next morning. She couldn't really walk properly. Her left foot was sort of slumping, she calls it. She was walking into doorways. The sound and light sensitivity were severe. She was still experiencing the numbness and tingling. And the symptoms just kept progressing and getting worse. We called the test clinic. They didn't respond for a couple of days. Finally, they responded, brought her in, did an exam, said, you know what? There were a couple of instances of transverse myelitis and MS in the previous trials. You might have MS and you should go see a neurologist.
Oh, my.
So we ended up in the ER 3 days later. They did all of the tests that they could, ruled out any of those, you know, pre-existing type conditions, and essentially said, we don't know what's going on, but best of luck to you, and sent her home to continue to decline.
So basically the same story. He's not, I don't think, talking about his daughter. I think he's talking about his wife.
His wife.
But the pattern is the same.
Right.
It's deny, deny, deny. And just, you know, hey, you know, we you're not helping our marketing effort. You got to go.
Right. One of the things they do is they try and push it out as a mental story. It's a mental problem. You have a psychological problem.
It's, yeah.
Right.
Right. It's all in your head. It's psychosomatic. Right. You know, right. you're a nut. How do these nuts get in our clinical trials? Crazy.
Right.
Okay. Next story out of Austria, hopefully not the first of many, but I don't think they'll do this, but we'll see. First ever nationwide lockdown for unvaccinated is in the cards. They say is on the cards. I think it's in the cards, but I'm an American. What do I know? The Australian government will make a determination on the two-tier lockdown system on Sunday, Chancellor Schallenberg said on Friday. He added the decision will be made following meetings with the governors of Austria's nine provinces. So one governor already sought permission from the government to lock down his province from Monday onwards. The area is currently recording more cases of COVID than any other province. A situation Stelzer described as dramatic, according to the Austrian press agency. And here they're saying some 3.1 million Austrians, 35% of the population, are not fully vaccinated. The country's vaccination rate is one of the lowest in Europe. And Schallenberg described the lackluster jab take-up as shameful. So there you have it. You're getting lectured by
government officials. So yesterday, we all piled in a car and drove south to do an interview with Wim Hof, which was an amazing experience. We'll run it in January. And but we stopped at sort of a roadside, you know, complex with a restaurant called La Place. And one of my colleagues went in and got some coffee and went to the ladies' room, came back out. So then I went in and they stopped me and said, where's your QR code? I said, I don't have one. They said, well, you can't come in. And my immediate reaction, so this is the first time this has happened to me. My immediate reaction was, oh, the food here is probably not safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Good reaction.
Well, because you realized, the creepy thing is happening here and, you know, we're better off staying away from creepy. So it was not the reaction I expected.
Yeah, better off staying away from creepy.
Stay away from Sounds. Creepy. Yeah.
I give that legal advice myself quite often.
Yeah, well, it follows to investment advisory advice. Don't buy creepy.
To be avoided.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, the next one is the highlight reel we're talking about. This is the highlight reel of healthy athletes dropping like flies after the clot shot. So let's just cut over to this and roll this. This is 2 minutes, but it flows really well because it's one after the other.
High school senior is in the hospital after collapsing on the tennis courts.
Breaking new details on the deaths of a high school soccer player.
Finland-Denmark star man Christian Eriksen collapsing towards the end of the first half.
The Kennedy High community mourning tonight after one of their high school football players died.
A South Carolina high school football player has died after collapsing at football practice.
Star college basketball player collapsing on the court. We want to warn you, the video may be difficult to watch.
Florida Gators star Keontae Johnson collapsing during the game.
A West Catholic high school student has died after collapsing during a football scrimmage.
On mile 8, she suddenly felt fuzzy and blacked out.
17-year-old Ryan Jacobs' heart stopped.
Unexpectedly collapsed on the field.
Megan went into cardiac arrest.
Collapsing during Friday night's football game.
For his collapse is unknown.
The reason why Manny collapsed in the first place still isn't known.
So you might be wondering how someone in such great shape could suffer cardiac arrest.
It's a rare thing that happens.
So you get it there.
So we're watching all over the internet more and more of these aggregations of the sudden death or collapse of athletes. And it's many more than this. We're now in the hundreds. But one statistic I just saw said that these kinds of collapses are 60 times their normal rate.
Wow. And yet
times.
The reporters are there, unknown, you know, unexpected. You might be wondering how these... Yeah, 12-year-old who's in shape has a double gripper on the soccer field.
It's rare. It's rare.
It's very, very rare.
It's very rare. Not everybody's dropping dead.
Right. That would be one super unexpected.
One of the reasons these are being aggregated is the young people seem to have trouble computing what's really going on. And so the question is, you know, you can't, one young person said, can't you get some celebrities to come out? Well, it's not safe for the celebrities to come out. Their life expectancy will be very short if they do. Although Eric Clapton has been able to do it. And I don't know if you saw Jordan Peterson recanted and said he was sorry he got the vaccination. He was quite upset about it.
I did see that.
Yeah. But the question is how to reach young people, and what a lot of the activists realize is just aggregating all the deaths of all these athletes. It's very compelling because they're so healthy.
Right. 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 To have one of, you could get away with one. Okay. With young people like that, you're going to get one mulligan, but they're in such great shape, you know, right, such a young age,
right,
that a series of them, it's like, okay, you got to address the problem.
Well, the other thing is they don't need the vaccination. If you look at the statistics on COVID, they have zero risk of death, right, from COVID.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
You got it. Okay. Continuing on, last story in Farmageddon. It's kind of morphing again. Morphing into climate change may cause increased rates of heart defects in babies.
How about that? The study
predicts 7,000 additional cases of congenital heart defects. Okay, 7,000. Rising temperatures will lead to an increased number of the infants born with congenital heart defects, according to Life Sciences of Sepolcula. I can't pronounce that name. The results of the new research suggest that we might start seeing this worrying trend as early as 2025. Okay? So right now, you have 40,000 babies every year born with congenital heart defects. And what these guys are predicting is 7,000, as we saw, babies born with congenital heart defects in 8 states over a 10-year period. So, you know, that's 750 a year, roughly.
Right.
It's not a huge number, 750 out of 40,000 in 8 states. Anyway, the study is completely speculative. If you look at the kind of stuff they're looking at, they're looking at temperature rises and, you know,
right, but here's the problem. And I heard Kennedy, both in Milan and Bern, go into this in detail. He went through the Pfizer, you know, the 6-month trial that they cut short. There were 22,000 in each group. In the vaccinated group, one person died of COVID. In the unvaccinated, 2 people died of COVID, which is why Pfizer says that their vaccine is 100% effective. Because,
oh, brother,
because 2 is 100% more than 1.
Greater than 1. Right. Right.
Okay. Now, in the 2 groups, in the vaccinated group, out of 22,000 people, 20 died. And the unvaccinated, 14 died. And in those 20 and 14, there was 1 heart attack in the unvaccinated and 5 heart attack deaths in the vaccinated.
Oh.
So you got a 48%. So you've got a 500%, 400 or 500% greater chance of dying of a heart attack if you're vaccinated. So on the theory that you're saving one person, you vaccinate 22,000 people and you save one person from COVID and right, you kill 4 or 5 with heart attacks.
Right. We'll save you from COVID, but five times the chance of a heart attack. Good luck to you.
But what Kennedy kept pointing out is these are Pfizer's numbers.
These numbers are telling you.
Right. The numbers are telling you. And so what their question is, how are they going to cover up the strokes and the heart attacks? You know, one report on the Doctors for COVID Ethics is, as of 6 weeks ago, right before the FDA approval for the 5 and 11, yeah, all the hospitals were rolling out protocols of how to give children blood thinners and deal with strokes in children. So the hospitals...
Are you kidding me?
No. What they're reporting is the hospitals are preparing for a wave of strokes and a need and blood clotting in children, so they know.
Of course.
And the question is, how are you going to gaslight? Well, here comes climate change.
Yep. You got it.
Yep.
Here it comes.
Yep. Here it comes. Here it comes.
Okay. Continuing the theme of gaslighting. Are you ready for your favorite OCC nominee?
Yep.
Yeah, you are.
Yep.
Here we go. This is Sala Omarova. I don't know when her hearing is, but she's been nominated by Biden to take over the head of the
office. You know, Tester and some other guys have teamed up and are coming out after her, so she may be in trouble. Let us pray.
Yeah, let's hope so. Okay, here we go.
Imagine what would it be like if instead of being just a public option for deposit banking, this would be actually the full transition. In other words, there will be no more private bank deposit accounts, and all of the deposit accounts will be held directly at the Fed. And there are very interesting implications from that thought experiment. For example, with the much more direct and proactive tools of monetary policy, like helicopter money, which is considered radical, primarily because economists really do not know how to manage the issue of what will happen in the inflationary environment when the central bank needs to contract the supply of money. How is it politically feasible for the central bank to effectively take money away from people's accounts?
Okay, that's very interesting, because the phrase helicopter money, remember, was part of BlackRock's going direct plan.
Right.
It appears right in their report. So in other words, she knows, Omarova knows full well, that there's helicopter money going into the system now in the forms of bond purchases, MBS purchases from non-bank financial entities. And she's saying, okay, well, if you get inflation from that, okay, we'll just take your bank account. Wouldn't that be great?
Right. Yeah.
So we give the money to the oligarchs, and we're going to take it away from your account.
Right. And you know why? Because all the money we're giving to the oligarchs causes inflation. But if we take it away from your account, we can slow down inflation. It's in the Vanderbilt Law Review article. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, there will be a video on that in the near future.
Good.
I have to take her to task. Okay. Anyway, let's continue on. We are going to go to FedWatch now. That probably was the first story in the FedWatch. But let's just go to the next story. That explains everything. Bankers bullied Australia into net zero. So here we go with more climate change right away. There's a story from the Australian. I'm going to quote the part of this. So this is a blog post where he's quoting a story, but I want to talk about the story itself. I'm not going to be able to zoom in. Out of the Australian, businesses and households would have faced, so whenever you see would have, you know bankers are getting ready to take your money. Businesses and households would have faced lower interest rate hike of up to 1.5% under expected penalties imposed by global financiers if the government had failed to adopt net zero emissions by 2050. Modeling from the climate package shows, Glasgow climate package, the penalty regime would have sparked a 17% investment collapse by the middle of the next decade, cutting 0.9% from the gross domestic product and making each Australian more than $650 poorer. So there you have the bankers threatening the government with consequences. This is the same playbook we saw in the global financial crisis with the TARP bailout.
Right.
We got a gun to your head, do what we want or we'll kill you.
Right. So this is interesting because Scott Morrison has held out against this, And I think the reason this is all getting out is because, he's caving because of the bullying, but they want people to know what the bullying is. Yeah. And that's a good sign. So, the more we can see, if you look at all the bullying that's being done at private corporations or countries or presidents, the more we can nail down exactly what tactics are being used, the better off we're going to be.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Oh.
Okay. Let's hit up the next story. The next story concerns the Biden mandate, the so-called mandate.
Okay.
It got into a little bit of legal trouble in the U.S. at the appellate level. So one notch down from the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court being at parity.
Why would he be in trouble just because he's doing something that's unconstitutional?
Well, he gets slapped down, and this is an interesting thing. This kind of cuts to the incompetence of people in positions of power, very much so. So let's look at the story from the Daily Mail. Judge on the Fifth Circuit cited tweet, Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, cited tweet by Ron Klain who's Biden's chief of staff, in the decision about vaccinations. And so here you go. Here's the tweet he's quoting. OSHA doing this vax mandate as an emergency workplace safety rule is an ultimate workaround for the federal government to require vaccinations, MSNBC anchor Stephanie Ruhle posted. And Klain retweets that. And one member of the bench, Englehart, ruled that Klain's retweet was an endorsement of the phrase workaround, meaning you guys know, okay, Cruz, Ted Cruz from Texas busts him out. He said, this is important. Cruz sees the tweet. He knows it's trouble right away. He knows they've made a mistake. He says, foolish retweet from White House chief of staff. He said the quiet part out loud, the workaround. Biden administration knows it's likely illegal, like the eviction moratorium, but they don't care. And that's exactly right. He's saying, you know, we know the mandate's illegal, so the way we'll get around it is we'll do this workaround through the emergency.
Right.
And the Fifth Circuit says that's not going to work.
Right.
And slaps it down.
Somebody this weekend got me to go look at Kevin Shipp's. Kevin Shipp is a CIA whistleblower. And Kevin Shipp took the position that 4.8 million people have essentially signed security contracts and that basically require them to follow orders. So if you're a CEO, so this is not just government people, this is private people. If you're a CEO, you've got a contract, and if you don't do what the deep state tells you, you could go to prison and lose all your assets because you've signed this national security contract. And anyway, so he says there's 4.8 million at least that he knows, or that the, you know, sort of the bureaucracy knows exists. There's probably more. And, you know, that would explain this kind of behavior, because you've got so much government money and so much government contracts and so much government regulatory clout that they can, you know, whether it's the government or the bankers, they can bully everybody from the behind the scenes, whether it's Australia or a publicly traded company.
That's amazing. I find that number, 4.8 million, just staggering.
I don't find that amazing. If you follow the history of the black budget and culminating in FASB 56, you know, and someday, I don't know if I've ever sent you our 2-volume on the missing money, but if you go through all the materials, this has been going on for a long, long time. In 2006, they adopted a waiver that allowed the National Security Director to waive all SEC regulations for any company.
But Shipp is saying 4.8 million contracts. Okay,
right.
Signatures on contracts. So that's 4.8 million people who've agreed to do certain behavior.
Right. So if you look at everybody who's coming through the government military over the last 20 or 30 years, and then you add all the CEOs of the banks and companies who are contractors, and probably the CFO and the chairman of the executive committee on the board, that's three a company, you know, times 5,000 companies, you know, and you go for 30 years. That doesn't surprise me.
Wow. But just the managerial task of 4.8 million contracts.
Right.
You know, that's incredible.
Well, but remember, you've got NASA set up to do surveillance on every one of them.
But again, someone's got to, you know, you've got to have people monitoring, signing on
the
other side of the contract.
No, it's all done with AI and software.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you can find a way
around
there.
I know what I dealt with. I mean, I really dealt with very invasive 24/7 surveillance. Most of it was AI and software, I think.
No kidding.
From what I...
So there's very few people on the government side of that equation.
There are tons of people. Doing surveillance and manipulating other people or other assets is the biggest job program in America. I told you my estimate of what they spent on, you know, my litigation investigation. I had 12 tracks of litigation, 18 audits and investigations, a smear campaign, and physical harassment. They had 24/7 surveillance. And it just, you couldn't get it to stop, and you couldn't get it to stop. And I finally realized, oh, these are jobs. These are people's contract. You know, whoever the contractor is that's doing the physical harassment is making a lot of money. And so that's why I sold my house and moved, because I knew the only way I could get it to stop was to force them to go in for a contract reauthorization. So I went to a system of living and working in four places on an unpredictable schedule, constantly moving, which meant their budget had to go up by 20 plus times to do the same thing in those four places on an unpredictable schedule. And I knew at that point they couldn't get a contract reauthorization. But I'll tell you something, John, if I hadn't understood federal government contracting, you know, I probably would never have been able to figure that out.
Right, you'd have been a sitting duck and you'd have played in their hands. Yeah.
Right. I don't know. It's a huge job program.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep it going. Next story. This is Johnson & Johnson, the first of three merger stories of three companies. It's hard to see. Let me zoom in. Johnson & Johnson plans to split into two public companies. Okay. So Johnson & Johnson is splitting off a $15 billion a year division that sells Band-Aid bandages, Tylenol medicines, and Johnson's baby powder in a shift indicating just how much healthcare has changed since the company helped pioneer the industry. The world's largest health products company by sales will separate its high-margin but risky prescription drugs and medical devices business from its storied but slower-growing consumer group, creating two publicly traded companies. Down in this story, though, further on, the decision comes after rivals including Pfizer and Merck decided to hive off their consumer businesses and double down on faster-growing pharmaceuticals. What I want you to see, though, is this graph. This is a very interesting graph.
Right.
So the dark blue is the consumer health. So you can see it's been flat for a long time. And the growers are what they're talking about, the pharmaceutical and the medical devices. You know, those are really growing like gangbusters. But I still don't understand, Catherine, why.
So here's why you would do this.
Why do this?
Though those faster growing businesses have significant political and legal risk. And part of what you're doing is you're protecting the cash cows like Tylenol from that risk. That's number one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But number two, so I think part of this is a risk management and the insurance players behind the scenes may have something to do with it. They're saying, you know, we want this asset peeled off from this risk position. So, but I think there's more going on because if you look at all the companies that are doing these splits, another reason may be we've shrunk the number of companies in the stock markets, even though we've had 2 years of good IPOs. If you split these companies up and you're expecting, you know, significant inflation in the stock market.
Yeah, you could really make bank.
Yeah, you can really have a lot more fun in terms of trading the financial markets. The Wall Street can make a lot more money. So I think part of this is repositioning the different growth and risk positions into different sort of liability things. The other thing, in a fast-moving environment like this, it's a nightmare to run very different kinds of companies. So if you look at the GE split, this is not as much for Johnson & Johnson, but for GE, if I was the chairman, I wouldn't want to run those three companies together. The businesses are too intense. They're going too fast. The political risk is too great. The change is too great. You're much better off focusing.
Yeah. Let's look at GE real quick. Unlike J&J, GE splitting into three companies. Shares jumped 15%, so the market likes this right away. General Electric said it was planning to split into three public companies. And here you go. Here they are, 1, 2, 3. The main company will be aviation business, led by CEO Culp. And then the other two, Strazek will head the combined renewable energy, power, and digital business. And then Arduini will helm GE Healthcare, the company said in the statement. And as soon as you said you can have a lot more fun, I realized, you know, maybe these executives are looking at Moderna and saying, you know, little tiny company, big time paycheck. Right. That may be the way we can really.
Absolutely.
Really.
Another that's been pointed out is now with FASB 56, you don't need a lot of government contracts and companies like this to wash all that money.
Right.
And so we're back to fundamentals. You need these companies to be fundamentally as productive as possible for whatever your purpose. But I will tell you this, after reviewing all the split ups this week, I'm convinced there's more to it than we understand yet.
I agree.
Right. So to me, this is an unanswered question. I got a lot of ideas and theories, But I want to see which way this goes, because we're watching a fundamental reengineering of the corporate infrastructure.
Totally agree.
It's happening, and this is a very big move. And there's a streamlining going on, and it's important.
That's funny. I've got theories too. We've got one more story to go. We've done two.
Right.
There's
right.
a third one coming. But in the meantime, let's cut over to our favorite guy from the Fed. No, I'm not talking about Jay Powell. I'm talking about Kashkari.
Oh God, I hate this guy.
He's back. He's back. He's back on whatever Face the Nation. What story? I don't even know. Sunday Talks, head of Minneapolis.
I always expect this guy to be looking, you know, right into the camera saying, "We come in peace."
This guy's a psychopath. This is the guy. Okay, Kashkari worked for Paulson. He was when Paulson was Treasury Secretary under Bush. Kashkari is the one who came up with $700 billion figure for the bailout. He went out and worked at PIMCO for a while. Then he's back at the Minneapolis Fed. He's president of the Minneapolis Fed. And he, in large part, is the Fed's choice as the younger spokesperson for the Fed. And he's been on Sunday morning TV before, but here he is again. He says inflation will get worse and prices will never come down. The percentage of inflationary change this year will continue going up as prices continue to skyrocket over almost every sector. CTH, that conservative treehouse where this is from, points out this issue because as the Fed continues printing current money, the value of future money drops and the price of good continues to climb. That's not exactly right, but it's close enough. The Fed has no tools to slow the current rate of inflation. That's what Omarova just said. As interest rates are disconnected from the cost of goods produced, the only thing the Fed can do is stop purchasing debt, QE, stop purchasing our own bonds at a slower rate. Even Neil Kashkari is telling Congress to stop spending money. And I'm not going to play the video, but if it was Face the Nation, I was right. That story is super interesting for a couple of reasons.
Right.
Number one, the Fed has announced it's tapering.
Right.
Okay. They're gonna taper bond purchases down to zero,
right.
supposedly by June.
We don't necessarily believe them, though.
I don't believe them at all, especially not when I see stuff like this. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But there's another way you could get inflation too, and that would be you have continued supply chain issues.
Mm-hmm.
So you're flooding the system with money, but that's slowing down. And obviously, if he's calling for inflation, they have no plans to pump the brakes on buying the money from the non-bank financial assets,
right.
which is what
they,
is driving the money into the retail sector.
They do have a way of creating offsetting inflation, deflation to slow down inflation.
Which is?
COVID restrictions. We're watching lockdowns all over the world.
Another
what are those lockdowns about?
Right.
That's engineered. You know, there's a hotline from the Fed to Fauci. You know,
right.
Okay, today you will engineer this much more in deflation. That's what it is.
That appearance by Kashkari to me is a tell that the Fed knows where it's headed. It's inflating ahead, inflation ahead.
Right.
The taper story is a bunch of, that's just.
I'll tell you what's very interesting.
Talk.
I don't remember if you saw this, but at the beginning of the pandemic, one of my favorite videos that I kept recommending was Larry Lindsey. Larry used to be a governor, and Larry Lindsey was the guy who got booted out with O'Neill by the Bushes when they tried to document and point out the real debt problem. And they made the mistake of saying that the Middle East wars would cost more. I think Rumsfeld was saying it was $100 million or something, and they were saying, no, it would cost more, so they got booted out. But Larry Lindsey gave an incredible presentation to the PK clientele for their wealth advisory business at all the way back at the beginning and said, you know, he basically predicted and said this inflation would arrive exactly as it has. So they knew way back then that that was coming.
Wow.
Right.
Back in the
Bush
days.
I'll pull that out and find it. It's a Lindsey. Lindsey is one of them. To me, he's one of the economists I most respect. Very, very capable. And a very, you know, but we knew.
I would
knew exactly what was
that.
Going to happen. Right.
I mean, as it is, I'm going to do a video of Kashkari again. He's due. to be on the
chopping block. Here's the thing. Go take a look at the Chatwood Index, because the basket of 50 household goods has been going up in America for the last 10 years, 8 to 14%. That's inflation.
Right.
Okay, this has been going on for 10 years. You know, come to Hickory Valley, Tennessee.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Keep it going. This next one's from the Visual Capitalist. This is a great resource. Visualizing the world's largest sovereign wealth funds. The top of this one, so they just go through them in order, kind of bouncing around from right to left. The first number one is $1.3 trillion, Norway, Government Pension Fund Global.
Norway, it's real interesting. Louisiana let the corporations take all the oil profits. Norway instead put some aside for the citizenry, you know, and it shows you what can happen if you manage your commodities right. But Norway is $1.3 trillion. It's huge.
That's unbelievable. The next one doesn't surprise me too much. It's in the U.S. and it's Vanguard at $1.3 trillion. So it's neck and neck with Norway. And then you have China Investment Corporation. You know, not a big surprise there. Kuwait, okay. But then the number five or six is Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, and they just go through them. And these are big numbers too. I mean,
they're major, major players in the investment markets, and it's going to be very interesting to see what they do in response to inflation. One of the reasons I sent you this is I noticed that the Secretary of Defense was going to meet with the head of Norway, and I thought, I'd like to know what this has to do with their allocations to U.S. Treasuries.
Boy, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And you saw there that Norway has a $27, $28 billion stake in Apple.
Right.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. I mean, Norway could do damage to Apple, not that it would, just by going on the market and dumping the stock.
Well, why do you have to send the Secretary of Defense there? Yes, I know there's a lot going on in the North Sea with Russia, but they had, apparently for the first half of 2021, Norway had a 9.4% return, all because of their equity portfolio. You know, they got that huge ride up. So,
yeah. You're talking about Lindsay and the Bush administration. Really is interesting, doubly so to me now because of the next story. And this is from Political Moonshine. This is a timeline of COVID-19 enterprise fraud and major dates, events, entities, and legislation. And the thing that jumps out to me on this is how early this starts in the Bush administration.
Yep.
And then you mentioned 9/11, but they just start in May of 2002 with Bush appoints Algerian-born director of the National Institute of Health. And it's Bush, 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 Bush. And I'll tell you something. This one I've highlighted here. I've highlighted because a guy I know is the head of infectious diseases at a major medical school, and he pointed it. I said, you know, the Fed, they have this, they're doing a lot of stuff they haven't done before, and they did it pursuant to a plan of BlackRock. And he said, oh, well, everybody was supposed to have a plan back in the Bush administration. We talked about this all the time.
Right.
A national, you know, pandemic influenza plan, and we all wrote out these plans. And he was kind of stuck on that talking point. It really wouldn't back off from it. And I see this timeline. And it's Bush's name and that plan all over it.
So I listened. If you come into Solarian, the news, we have the videos from the press conference in Bern and Milan. And then on the next page, the rally. And Kennedy gave four incredible speeches. But one of the things we kept hammering on was the passport, the vaccine passports, or in Italy they call them the green passports, have nothing to do with healthcare. And Kennedy goes through the extent to which he says, if they have anything to do with healthcare, how come they're run by the finance ministry and not the health ministry? But then he goes back to the history of the CIA involvement in building, you know, both the pandemics, the scenario 201 and the passports. And he says, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think the CIA is a health ministry. And then he says, from 1947 to, I think it was 2015, the CIA's business was engineering coup d'etats, mostly in democratic countries. And he said, yeah. And that's what this is. This is a coup d'etat. And he points out that the woman who's now national security director was the deputy director from the CIA who ran the 201 event. So the pandemic has been very good for her.
Yeah. Yeah, I checked Solari this morning, the website. I mean, the video is up of you and Kennedy sharing the stage
there. Right, right. So it's in the Solari in the news.
Yeah, right. I just watched a couple of minutes of it. Yeah, in the news, exactly.
Right. Okay. Kennedy has been at this so long that he can deliver an incredible, you know, whether it's 10 minutes or an hour, an incredible speech. And it's just fact, fact, fact. You know, he's a litigator. Fact, 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 fact. And it's, you know, the facts are brutal. And he's got them all.
He did seem, before the sort of event got rolling, just sort of sitting there, very relaxed, poised, not a worry in the world.
Well, what was interesting is if you watch how the crowd, he went down and sort of shook hands with the crowd in Milan, they love him.
Really?
You know, because if you're someone who understands what's going on and you want a political leader who's willing to fight for freedom, and particularly kids, you know, because his whole thing is kids, and, you know, they just absolutely resonate with him. And his record has been so clear for so long, and the treatment of him in the media is so brutal. It's almost like the brutal, I don't know if you've watched any of the really brutal media treatment of him, but it's almost like it's boomeranged.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. The people sort of like Trump, but they take it as a sign of reliability. The fact that you're getting pummeled in the mainstream media means you're, yeah.
Yeah, but the way they've gone after him is some of the ugliest stuff I've ever seen. It's really ugly. And he's trained to handle it well.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's...
Like I say, he didn't have a care in the world sitting there at the dais. Like, yeah. Day in the park. Yeah. Okay.
No, he's such a hard worker guy. He's very hardworking. So he's not laissez-faire about it. He really cares.
Huh.
He's a litigator. He's not. Well, yeah.
Litigators are a dime a dozen. You should know that by now. Well, anyway.
I like special litigators.
Yeah, I'm kind of joking. The next story is to shift gears to CBDC and crypto. I find this story interesting the more I think about it. And this is factoring into my theories about what may be going on, but I'll get to that another time. MasterCard will launch crypto cards in Asia amid heightened local demand for digital currencies. The cards with MasterCard's name on them will convert digital tokens into fiat currency that can be used anywhere MasterCard is accepted. The initiative is part of MasterCard's global crypto card program, which seeks to support native digital currencies as payment tools. The total market for crypto assets, this is the global market, hit $3 trillion. And here's interesting. Major financial institutions like JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Capital One increased crypto talent hiring by 40% in the first half of 2021. Facilitated crypto payments may therefore be an attempt to keep issuers tied to MasterCard's network as they start thinking about offering crypto services. The reason I find that so interesting is that if, you know, MasterCard is, as I've said on this show, is the front, okay? And when you make a $100 purchase at a retailer, let's say it's the Gap, you're buying some jeans, whatever, you're adding $100 to the money supply because MasterCard is backed by a bank.
Right.
And I forget which one, it may be Comerica, I'm not sure. But the point is that there's a commercial bank and it's creating money when you engage in these transactions. So now that they're in the crypto space, the question is, how is that working on the balance sheet? Okay, if you're creating $100 of new bank money with your crypto, does that mean that crypto is the asset? And if the answer is yes, as I suspect that it is, that crypto is the asset that corresponds to the $100 of money that MasterCard appears to be fronting you, what that means is there's commercial banks that are now exposed to a decline in crypto asset valuations. And that those banks, to the extent that they are out there hanging on a limb, depending on crypto asset valuations, they could be flushed down the toilet.
Right. I also think MasterCard is looking to hook into whatever the ID 2020 and vaccine passports. So they want to be there to link those up. And that's part of getting out on that infrastructure.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in that story.
Right.
But that's another one of those interesting developments to keep your eye on, the development being how bound up.
Did you read the piece Corey Diggs did with our support for vaccine passports? Because MasterCard's all over the passports.
Yeah, right. You see their name again and again. But the question is, how involved, how deep into crypto are the commercial banks exposing themselves? That's a central issue with CBDC.
Right.
In other words, who are the intermediaries going to be?
Right.
With CBDC, you have the Fed at the top, and the people at the bottom. Who's in the middle?
Right.
You know, how many commercial banks? Anyway. Moving on, next story. How to eliminate crypto capital gains taxes by investing in opportunity zones. So the question, how do you eliminate the taxes by investing in crypto? And they don't really provide an answer here, but they're saying you can. Okay.
Right. So I brought this up. This is an old article from Forbes. I brought this up because I've been focused on rolling equity market sort of tech company capital gains over into opportunity zones. But somebody pointed out to me that they're also taking crypto capital gains. And there's a potential for a significant shift. Because I know a lot of people are trying to get their money out of cryptos. So, you know, they've had gains and now they're trying to take some and play from their winnings.
Yeah, to dial it back, right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And they're facing, huge capital gains.
Yeah, that's right. And anyway, the bottom line is that you could avoid capital gains with crypto. So in other words, it does seem to be the case.
You can't avoid capital gains with crypto. You can avoid capital gains with the opportunity zones.
Yes, okay. You could. There's a way to be in crypto and avoid capital gains with the opportunity zones.
So one drum I beat at the end of every year, and somebody said, you've got to beat this drum again. There's always the danger that they drop the price dramatically on crypto after the end of the year. So if you're trading right now and you have taxable gains and then your position drops dramatically, if you don't reserve in dollars the money to pay your taxes, you could find yourself sideswiped. That happened badly in 2017. And I keep being told, I don't know if it's true, that many people in crypto think they don't have to pay taxes. And, or that it's secret. So rest assured, you have to pay taxes, and rest assured it's secret. And if you have taxable gains in 2021, for God's sakes, you know, take enough money to pay your taxes and escrow it in the currency you have to pay taxes in.
Right.
Do not leave it in crypto.
Right. Big mistake.
Right.
It looks more and more like crypto is going to be used to yank the rug out from people and institutions. If it's flushed.
You know something, the possibilities of funny business with crypto are growing. You know, they are expanding radically. And the funny business of what can be done is frightening.
Yeah.
Right.
It is. And then you saw the number, the $3 trillion market. So we're getting into real territory. We just saw the sovereign wealth funds. You know, the biggest one was $1.3 trillion, and crypto global market is $3 trillion. I mean.
Right. So now it's starting, you know, it's moving into where they can have some real fun with it.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Right. Right. Where you can start trading chess pieces.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Next story is space, military, and global turf wars. This is the first and last story we will see from the Telegraph on Solari, because there's no way to get to the story that not behind a paywall or with a million pop-ups. But I don't think we need that much because it's straightforward. U.S. reactivates nuclear artillery unit in Germany. Why Russia should be worried? An American nuclear artillery unit has been reactivated in Germany for the first time since the Cold War, and is to be armed with new long-range hypersonic weapons. Well, there you have it. That's why
the U.S. is trying to create first strike capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Pretty straightforward.
Right. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. That's not a very reassuring story, though.
No.
as brief as it
no,
was.
No, basically, if you look at what we did from the time we basically ended the missile treaty and have been moving in on Russia, it's quite remarkable. If you look at one of those maps with all the different moves we've made to sort of encroach.
Yeah.
That's
Russia's encroachment, though. Their borders are remaining fixed right. around our...
They moved their country their right next to all of our bases. It's quite extraordinary. Yeah.
The next story is the third leg of the trifecta of unmergers.
This is big.
Spinoffs. This is huge. This is big.
Right.
And we don't really know what's going on here, but Wall Street Journal, Shell to move headquarters to London amid energy transition. Very interesting story. Let me zoom in here. Oil giant said Monday that bringing an end to its complex structure should make it easier for investors to value the company. At the same time, it is committed to transitioning to lower carbon energy. The shares traded 2.1% higher following the announcement. Yeah, so what? The proposal, which is set to be put to a shareholder vote next month, comes as Shell faces increasing pressure from investors and environmental groups over its carbon emissions. Down a little bit farther in the story, though, this thing here is interesting. Separately, or not so much, a Dutch court in May, ruling on a case brought by environmental groups, said Shell should move faster to cut its emissions. So you got a Dutch court saying, hey, you got to cut your emissions. Shell said Monday that moving its headquarters from The Hague to London wouldn't affect the Dutch court case. Okay, but would the Dutch court case be affected by the move?
I don't know. this is not the only... They're going from a dual listing in terms of which exchange they trade on to just one. BHP is doing the same. That's another one to look at. But there's no doubt this is radically simplifying their structure. One question is, does it have anything to do with Brexit? Because when they were, they had a dual structure and both countries were in the EU and then London, UK pulls out and now it's much more difficult and complicated because of that. The other thing, and this is what I said to you about this story, I don't know if they're moving to the UK or they're moving to the City of London. And my bet is they're moving to the City of London. And my bet is this has a lot to do, if you're going to pick sides after Brexit, I always said the Queen wanted out of the EU because they wanted the British offshore haven system protected from the ECB and the Germans. So I think Shell is basically throwing in with the city and the money in the offshore havens. Okay. So that's my
bet. Add to that. I will tell you, I'm betting on that London means City of London myself.
Right, right.
Because London, City of London is knee deep in the green movement and climate change and carbon credits and all that. And Shell's going to be a part of that. And this
Shell's
going to
be a big part of that if they're doing this. I don't know what they've been promised, but it's big.
I agree. I think that this has a lot to do with the climate change and the green credits and the carbon credits and the new financial.
And the thing that scares me about this, at any time, so off and on, I've had a lot of clients and done business in the oil patch. And any time I ran into Shell, they were deeply respected. They were considered deeply capable and deeply respected.
Really?
Yeah. And so I find it frightening that a deeply competent company would throw in with the green climate change bunch in London. But there's there's 21 trillion in the offshore havens, John. What can I tell you? Well,
we both know that has nothing to do with the environment and everything to do with the do-re-mi.
Right. Right.
But, I mean, please.
Right.
Okay. Next story in space and global turf wars. And you and I might have different takes on this story, but let's just get into it. Russian anti-satellite missile test endangers space station crew, says NASA. So the story here is an anti-satellite missile test Russia conducted on Monday generated a debris field in low Earth orbit that endangered the International Space Station and will pose a hazard to space activity for years, officials say. The 7-member crew were directed to take shelter in their docketed spaceship capsules for 2 hours after the test as a precaution to allow for a quick getaway had it been necessary. The research lab, orbiting about 250 miles above Earth, continued to pass through or near the debris cluster every 9 minutes. every 90 minutes, but NASA specialists determined it was safe for the crew to return to the station's interior after the third pass. Very interesting story there. What's your read on that?
So the first announcement was there was a debris-generating event. It took a couple stories for it to turn into, you know, the Russians were to blame. So I'm suspicious. Right. So yeah. We know there was a debris-generating event, but I'm not sure what it was. What I will say is this is a big problem, and it's going to become a bigger and bigger problem because space debris, you know, you have the Wild West out there, and there's no governance structure to allow for proper management of the infrastructure. And, you know, the Koreans are throwing up satellites, and the Indians are throwing up satellites, and we're throwing up satellites, and the Russians are throwing up satellites. But nobody sat down and really provided for the space debris problem, and it's going to get much, much worse.
I'm super skeptical of the whole thing. I think it's really? A money grab. Yeah, it's a money grab. They're like, oh, yeah, there's rocks. There's all this trash floating around the space. We're flying into it at 27,000 miles an hour. It's like, really? That's really going on. Let me see the pictures. Let me see the video. You know, you got a video camera. Bring it down to Earth. Let's take a look at your video. Have you seen any damage?
So you think there wasn't a space debris event?
I think there was some sort of event, but I think the debris story is, I'm quite skeptical. I think it's just a play like, oh, we got all this debris. It's, you know, and then we need $100 billion for the space debris problem.
No, I think there's a real space debris problem.
Okay.
I really do.
I don't know. I just know how these stories look and smell. And I don't know. We'll see.
I think something happened, but I don't know what it was. I certainly don't believe it was the Russians. The Chinese, and I think it was 2008, the Chinese did do an anti-satellite test. They blew up a satellite and created a mess. So, okay. Yeah, that is,
I mean, if you fly into something at 27,000 miles an hour, that's going to leave a mark.
Yep. Anyway, okay, keep going.
Okay. All right, let's keep it going. From Solari, taxation with or without representation, who will take actions and what actions can they take? And here it is all laid out. What do we got?
So I just wanted to remind everybody that this is there and we've made it public so that the subscribers can share it with friends, family, attorneys. And here's the thing. If the central bankers are going to try and take over fiscal policy and tax us without representation and literally take money out of our bank accounts, then we have to deal with the fact that maybe it's time to assert jurisdiction over our taxes and make sure our taxes are used for lawful purposes. Under the Constitution, if money's being spent in criminal ways, we're responsible to stop it. So this is a piece that Carolina Betts, I wrote to create sort of a discussion of, okay, what do we do about the taxes and how do we go after the taxes? You know, how do we bring taxes back into lawful and productive use? And this is a complex conversation, and it's a conversation that touches, you know, everybody and everything. At some point, if you look at all the attorney generals who are suing, they're going to have to come down on this issue because you can't continue to pay taxes to a federal government that is using the money illegally. This is at the heart of the rule of law question.
Wow. Yeah, it really is. I mean, taxation obviously cuts to the very foundation of the U.S. You know, it's a fundamental issue.
Well, for the last, since 1998, the federal government has operated completely outside of the financial management laws. Completely.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah, I could see why you would peg the date of the coup in the late 90s if that's the case.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's keep it going. Also, the next story, Solari in Tennessee, next story from Tennessee as well.
Good news for Tennessee. I'm so excited. Governor Lee, who had just about the worst executive order on COVID-19, and God bless the Tennessee state legislatures, they passed a bill basically saying, no, you can't do any of that stuff here.
Yeah, sets up a head-to-head conflict with Biden here. New legislation outlaws vaccine and mask mandates for government entities and schools and places restrictions on what businesses can do to ensure patrons are vaccinated. The new law also places restrictions on masking mandates statewide. They quote a legal expert here and says the law is in clear conflict with President Biden's vaccine mandate order for businesses with more than 100 employees. Same legal expert also said he expects Congress to exercise its power to withhold funding from organizations that violate Biden's order, calling
so,
it one of the most...
So if I was the Tennessee AG, I would look seriously at creating escrows by county that allow counties to escrow their federal taxes and assert offsets against anything the federal government withholds.
Yeah.
Two can play that game.
But that sets up a real issue of federalism there with Tennessee.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. So
that's a kind
but
of
But here's the thing. The federal government is in violation of all the financial management laws.
I agree, but the final arbiter of that dispute is the Supreme Court. And that's the kind of case that gets the Supreme Court quick, state versus feds. So we'll see. When we had, you really want to bet a lot of money on how the Supreme Court's going to come out on the vaccine mandates? I mean, I wouldn't want to touch that bet with a 10-foot pole.
Well, my favorite one, I told you what my favorite one was, is not offset against the government, offset against the banks.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court is almost always going to come down on the side of the federal government if it can.
Agreed. Right.
But they're not always going to come down on the side of the banks if they can.
Right. Right. Interesting point.
So I prefer the offset against the banks.
Yeah, I like that too. It's a great angle. Okay. Next story. Back to the Fifth Circuit. U.S. Appeals Court affirms hold on Biden COVID-19 vaccine mandate. The court writes, the mandate is staggeringly overbroad. It's a one-size-fits-all sledgehammer that makes hardly any attempt to account for differences in the workplace and workers. Circuit Court Judge Kurt Engelhardt, who we heard from earlier, wrote for the panel, the public interest is also served by maintaining our constitutional structure and maintaining the liberty of individuals to make intensely personal decisions according to their own convictions, even or perhaps particularly when those decisions frustrate government officials like Chief of Staff Klain, the court is saying there. Very good news for the
people. Very good news. It's very good news.
Vaccine. Yeah.
So that's fantastic. You know, the high speed train has been slowed down a lot.
Yes.
Right.
Now that said, that is the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So it's a regional circuit. It covers Texas, Louisiana, maybe a couple others.
Right.
And there's I don't know, 12, I think, regional circuits in the U.S. It'd be nice to see a lot more appeals courts get on board. But ultimately, I think that one's, you know, that's headed for the Supreme Court.
Right.
Pretty clearly, I think. Okay, shifting gears now. Here you are. I'm going to try to find this in the news with you and Kennedy.
Yeah.
And it's right down here.
Yep.
You zoom in. There you are. Let's click on that. Whoop. We gotta zoom back. There we go. And there's Mr. Poise. But look at so who's there on the panel? Tell us. You,
it's Senta Dupuy, who runs the European Children's Health Defense, and then Robert Kennedy, and then myself, and then one of the translators.
Okay. That's I wondered who the Anyway, so that's so you can
now,
see
now the important
here.
One is the in Switzerland. So we went to Bern on Friday and then Switzerland on Saturday. And the hold on just a second. Hello? Hello? Sorry, somebody's knocking at the door. Oh. And we were in Bern on Friday. The Swiss are having a referendum. They had a referendum to vote down the COVID laws. And it didn't pass. There are many people who believe it did pass, and then it got rigged. But they got it back on the ballot right away, and that referendum is November 28th. And the reason that Kennedy came and European Children's Health Defense made such a big effort is this is a very important referendum. If the Swiss can roll back the COVID laws and the vaccine passports in Switzerland, you know, I kept saying to them, you are the lighthouse. If you do this, you know, it will inspire and make such a difference around the world. It will be the, you know, what do they call it? The shot heard round the world. So,
yeah, yeah, right.
You know, one thing I would ask for is everyone pray for Switzerland. Just pray for Switzerland in this referendum. We want them to vote no.
Yeah. Right. So November 28th, that's coming
November
up.
November
28th. Yeah, we'll yeah. see. You know, the elections haven't been such a good source of news for the people recently. Yeah.
So, you know, I had one ally who used to always say, our circumstances are far too dire for the luxury of realism.
Yeah.
So I'm praying that Switzerland can put, if anybody can put it over the top, it's Switzerland.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, congratulations to you for going out there and, you know, sticking up for the team.
That was Kennedy. A long drive.
How long was it?
What? So Mads Palvik came from a friend of ours, picked us up, and he drove from Stockholm, picked up Mads, drove to Stavoren, and we had a great sort of evening. I cooked a big pot of soup, and then we drove to Bern and did the Bern event the next day, and then we drove to Milan and did the event the next day. And, you know,
how many
it was
hours?
Well, then I had to drive back the next night. So, you know, that's like 40 hours in the car. Oh. Doing all the stuff. But remember, other people were driving. I was working. And but we came back to Basel and then had a little brunch Sunday morning and then drove back to Stavoren. So wow. it was quite a whirlwind trip. But you know something? The people in Switzerland and in Milan were so wonderful. We had a lot of Swiss subscribers at the rally in Bern. And, you know, when you're with when you're with 50,000 people who are just absolutely committed to freedom, it feels great. So
yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah.
I'll bet. That's great. You got to meet subscribers out there too.
Yeah. No, I saw a lot of subscribers. It was fun. Anyway.
Wow. That's
great. I want everybody to pray that the Swiss vote no to the COVID restrictions on November 28th.
Yeah, 40 hours in a car. Wow. Okay. Thank you.
Well, I want them to vote no.
I guess so.
I guess so, yeah.
No doubt about that anymore, is there?
No.
Anyway, last story in Pushback from Natural News. Beyond Meat stock plunges as Americans reject Frankenfood burgers. Let's see if I can zoom in a little bit here. While globalist organizations like World Economic Forum continue to push people to consume fake meat products for the climate, Americans are largely rejecting chemical-laden frankenfoods like Beyond Burger, which is made by Beyond Meat. This company reports a third-quarter loss of 87 cents, far exceeding the 39 cents per share expected by Wall Street. The CEO claimed the new competitors are putting pressure on Beyond on the company's market share, but CNBC reports that the data does not support the idea that the drop in demand can be attributed to other companies stealing their customers. I would agree with that. Unlike many homemade plant-based burgers, there are actually no vegetables in Beyond Burgers. While they do not contain GMOs like other fake burgers on the market, they do contain similar amounts of calories and fat to a beef burger, along with significantly more sodium. They also have carbs, which a regular beef burger does not contain unless you put it on a bun.
Huh. It would not surprise me if all the adverse events on the vaccinations and the lies on the vaccinations were reverberating against synthetic meat, because people are beginning to realize these guys, they don't care about us. They'll kill us. You know, they'll experiment on us. They're psychopaths, you know, and they're happy to kill us. So you don't trust what's in it. You don't understand what's in it. You don't trust what's in it, but you know you can't trust them.
Yeah. So. I will say personally, you know, I've this whole injection thing and what's in it and is graphene in it, you know, nobody knows what's in. You know, the same point is well taken. It's like, well, if they're doing this with medicine, they're damn sure going to be doing it with food too. And I've started to cut back on, you know, stuff I don't know about and go more with, it's more expensive to buy fruits and vegetables, put them in a juicer, but you know, better for you.
So, yeah, I'm recording. So, wait a minute. Let me just check the time. So, I remember when Amazon bought Whole Foods, I was walking up to the meat counter and I started to reach for the organic hamburger. And I stopped and I said, do I trust Amazon for quality control on this? And I said, no, I don't. I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm not buying anything where I can, you know, a head of lettuce, I can see what it is. but hamburger, that was it. That was it.
Yeah. Right. I totally agree. Don't trust Amazon for anything. Okay. It's time for charts. You
okay.
ready? Let's hit them. First charts are for the companies we talked about.
I wanted to take a look at J&J and GE.
Yeah. Yeah. So here we go. J&J is there. GE is there.
J&J was clearly helped by the injections. So they got a lot of money thrown their way. And one of the things if you look at when you look at companies like J&J or GE, they're clearly struggling to maintain corporate profits. And the government is stepping into the government and the central banks are stepping into the breach more and more. That's what we saw with J&J. And sort of the healthcare game has been more about subsidizing the stock market than it has been about providing healthcare. But if
J&J
they're not tracking that far away from the S&P.
J&J is half the S&P. S&P's up 60%, J&J's 30.
Right. That's true. But it's not, you know.
In the scheme of things, that's not that much, but.
Right.
I don't know. GE, I get GE, well, it's tracking this.
What
S&P
I would
500.
Say is without massive subsidy coming from government contracts and purchases, both of these companies would be in the tank.
Oh, that's for sure.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on. This next is, I'm sorry that these are animated. I forgot to take off the animations. This is West Texas Intermediate Light Crude Oil, up 66.55%. That's year to date. So we have a few charts here.
I took a look at this because the Americans have just asked the Chinese to let some oil out of their reserves.
Right.
Because the prices are running up. And anyway, so I just wanted to take a look because the energy costs are rising. There's no doubt about it.
No question about it. But this is the year-to-date chart for crude oil. Let's take a look at the year chart here. That's 1 year, up 95% over a year. That's amazing.
Right.
Certainly, I'm paying a lot more to pump in the U.S.
Right, and significantly more than the S&P.
Yeah.
So about 30% ahead of the S&P. And remember, for American companies, particularly American manufacturing, labor is the second biggest expense. Energy is the biggest expense. So this is bad news for the equity markets.
That's really bad.
You know, it's going to hit corporate profits.
And then the final chart on the oil is a 5-year chart. That's up heavy there too.
Yeah, and what that shows you is, you know, the magic virus was very deflating.
Boy, it does show you that, doesn't it?
Right.
Look at that. I mean, if you look down here,
right.
This is April of 2020.
Right.
You know, that thing's off 60% there.
Right.
Holy cow! But then, It's been all aces since then. Okay.
Yeah, but do you know how much you can make shorting and then going long on that?
Yeah, Catherine. I mean, I do know how much you could make shorting long if you time it right.
Right.
That's easier said than done. I don't, you know.
Not if you're doing it. If it's a takedown and you take it down, the timing's easy.
Yeah, well, good luck. I'm not going to take my chance.
No, I'm not saying we should, but those who are engineering the takedown, they put the positions on and then they take it down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been going on for a long, long time.
Yeah, the recipients of the $3.whatever trillion to play with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're in good shape. I tend to be the one at the wrong end of that trade. Stay away from that stuff. Okay. All right, keep it going. Last final chart is our favorite. Here we go.
Yeah.
And again, you know, every week we see at the very bottom of the chart, there's good old VIX.
Yep.
And at the top of the chart, you know, we have all the energy and the food. there you go. The stuff that matters, all there.
You know, ever since 2007, you have the entire U.S. financial money management infrastructure betting, and you see that in the VIX at the bottom, betting that the Fed is going to pull them out.
Yeah.
And the day is going to come when the Fed doesn't. It leaves them hanging out. And they've never known a world where the Fed didn't pull them out.
They've never known a world where the Fed didn't pull them out. Yep. You got it.
That's going to be a real shocker.
Yeah.
So natural gas is down to number two.
Yeah, it's down. Okay. It's down all the way down to 98.7% up.
Uh-huh.
This is a bad one for me, seeing coffee, Mr. Coffee there. Yep. Up at 81%. I don't like seeing that. That's not good. But boy, food and energy. That's not good. And Catherine, this has been week after week we see this too.
So Kennedy kept pointing out they shut down a million businesses in the United States last year with no due process and no, you know, offset. Yeah. And now, you know, all the people who lost their jobs and livelihood, now they're going to experience skyrocketing energy and food costs.
You know, I just checked the Treasury Daily, the report of the Treasury balance at the Fed, and it's down to about $200 billion. I mean, you know, what's going to happen when these stimulus checks run out and the energy costs and food costs continue skyrocketing? And the Fed's telling you, the fast cash carry, the idiot, is telling you they're going to keep going up.
Right. They are going to keep going up. So for many years, I've hammered food prices. You know, this is about quality, it's about supply, and it's also about price. So you have to line up reliable sources of food now.
Right.
And if you haven't done it, takes years to do it well. You have to do it. You know, and the economics of growing your own and doing a garden or planting an edible landscape are skyrocketing. So we have a food series on the Salieri Report. If you haven't plugged into it and started listening to it, you know, you want to do it. There are incredible resources, including, you know, we do a lot with the Weston Price Foundation, and they have groups all over the country as well. We have the Connect software now, so you can find people in your place and start getting together. Because the way to get food economically is to do it as a group.
Right.
You know, there's all sorts of benefits of organizing for that. But I'm telling you now, if you haven't started to organize to make sure you have reliable sources of food on an economic basis, you have to do it. You must do it. So
yeah, that's a great point. You know, in Raleigh, I see some developments. I remember some near Wake Deck North where groups of condominiums will have a few greenhouses where they get together and plant stuff themselves. It's a great idea.
Well, it's the ultimate luxury project. I've seen all these new developments where they have luxury retirement homes and a farm right in the middle.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic idea. I love that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that wraps it up for this week. What a week.
Okay, I want to mention two things. One is we had a subscriber write in and said, we need more actions we can take. We need, you know, what should we do? If you're a new subscriber and you haven't checked out our article, Coming Clean, what I would recommend you do a search, pick it up, Coming Clean, and start going through the 24 steps to Coming Clean. It will lead you into a wealth of actions you can take. If you're interested on the real estate and investment asset side, make sure to listen to the last four equity overviews, and we've got a great collection of links. And finally, big story, you have a new video. We've been waiting for it.
Yeah, I do. It's a new video. I posted it yesterday, meaning, was it Tuesday, called The Tale of Two Crises. I know that's not the Pool of Crisis. However, Larry Fink does not know that. So you'll see. see, Larry did not pay attention during his Latin classes. So he thinks it's crises. Anyway, the video is about, it compares. It says, look, the global financial crisis 2008-2009 is a much different animal than what we have now. What we have
now, and it's very important to understand the difference.
It's very important. This is this is what I'm saying is the Fed is and Treasury trying to climb out of the debt problem that is now going on.
Can't be climbed out of.
It's out of. It can't be. but they're going to try it. It looks like they're inflating their way out. Classic recipe. Anyway, so it's a 40 plus minute video, but I'm finally kind of finding my rhythm on the video. So I'm going to start turning them out here, I think. Anyway.
Okay.
And I'll have some more short ones. But finally, what the last question, how do you get to the food food growing on the Solera report?
So our food series is at food.solera.com. And okay. Or if you go to the homepage and it says series, you can click and go to the food series. And we do, or just go to the search bar and put in food and you'll pull up a, you know, there's a wide selection of resources. And one thing I can recommend to you, because I think they have one, there's a magazine called Edible Communities. And they have magazines all, it's a franchise operation, and they have magazines all over the country. And if there's an Edible Communities magazine for your area, that is the best way to find all the food resources. Ediblecommunities.com.
Yeah.
See if they have one for your area. The other thing is find the local Weston Price clubs in your area as well. And if you go to the Weston Price is... you know, we've been a member for Weston Price for years, and they send out dictionaries of food, you know, sort of best places in different areas to access food.
Are you saying Weston, W-E-S-T-O-N?
W-E-S-T-O-N, Weston Price Foundation.
I thought you were saying, okay.
All right.
Okay. Good to know.
All okay. Right. Fresh food. Thanks John. So much, have Catherine. A great time. No money in markets next week, and it's going to be Thanksgiving. So I have to wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and to tell
happy
you
Thanksgiving.
On behalf of the whole Solera team, we're giving thanks for your presence on our team.
Oh, well, nice to hear. Thank you so much. This has been a great experience. I've gotten way better presentations as a result of doing. No, I have. I've learned what I'm doing.
You
I'm
do a better job of un-gaslighting us than anyone I know.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Bye.
See you in a couple of weeks. Bye.